The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Jim Butts from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today we're going to do something we haven't done before on the show. We usually, as you know, read articles from the Remnants magazine. And we appreciate all those thousands of people who share their memories of events that made a lasting impression on their lives by writing and sending them to Remnants magazine. We all have many memories that delight us, but, you know, life's journey always has moments that we would just as soon forget. And what about walking into a room and forgetting what you were going to get? Is it normal or should you be concerned? Today we're very pleased to have two people whom I consider experts in the field of psychology, and they are Dr. Rebecca Smith, who's professor and chair of psychology at the University of Mississippi, we affectionately called Ole Miss. And Dr. Smith has authored numerous scientific articles on memory. She's also a fellow of the American Psychological Association and also the fellow of the Psychological Science Scientific. And she's written numerous articles on the memory. Also, we're happy to have Dr. Reed Hunt, who is also a research professor at Ole Miss. Dr. Hunt has authored numerous scientific articles, authored three books on memory, and has appeared on Frontline as an expert witness. Welcome to both of you. Glad to have you on the program today.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Okay, well, let's start off with one of my questions about memory. And what is the psychology view of memory?
Well, Jim, psychology takes a much broader view of memory than most people likely consider. And that is that memory is an extremely important and central concept in the study of the mind. And the principal function of memory from the standpoint of psychology is to make use of prior experience in order to service current needs, solve problems, and in many cases for social interaction. When we talk with other people, we typically are talking about shared experiences or explaining an experience to someone that they've not had, but it requires the use of our memory. However, by defining memory this broadly, we go beyond just what most people think of memory as trying to remember something, but again, very broadly as the use of prior experience to service current needs, whatever they might be. And it's an extremely important function because essentially what this means is memory is the vehicle which learning operates through. So when we have learned something in the past and we use it in the present, really what we're what's really happening there is memory is operating.
Now, many people think that their memory is not as good as they would like it to be. Why is that?
Well, in my opinion, it's most likely because memory is like many of our mechanical devices. We never notice it until it fails. So people assume that they have poorer memory. And I'll defer to Dr. Smith for elaboration on that point.
So as Dr. Hunt was saying, we don't pay attention to memory when it's working. Just like our car starts every morning, we don't think about the fact that our car is very reliable. It's only when it stops and doesn't work that we think, oh, this is a terrible car. It's not working right. And so it's the fact that we notice when we have a memory failure and we don't notice when memory is working correctly that sometimes leads people to think that their memory is not as good as it actually is. Another reason that we may overestimate our memory difficulties rather than thinking about how well our memory actually works is that we tend to focus, as Dr. Hunt said, on memory as a narrow view rather than taking a broader perspective on what memory really is. So as Dr. Hunt said, memory is the influence of prior experience on our current situation. So if a person is listening to this show and comprehending what we're saying, they are using their memory. Memory is more than remembering a list or a name. We use memory to understand language and concepts. So if you're listening to this radio show, you're using memory. The difference is we aren't trying to remember the time that we learned that language. If you brushed your teeth this morning, you were using memory. There was some time when you were a child where someone showed you the mechanics of how you brush your teeth. You don't have to think about remembering what's the process of brushing your teeth. You just do that. Now, you do have to remember to brush your teeth, and memory is a part of remembering to do something in the future. But many aspects of what we do with memory is using the past to influence our current behavior, to solve current problems, without actually trying to recollect that information. So memory is involved in recalling our distant past, the way we typically think of memory, but it's also remembering what you did yesterday or earlier today. Memory helps us to know who we are and helps us to plan for the future. While we notice the times that we cannot remember something that we're trying to remember, we typically don't notice when our memory is working just fine, and for most of us, it works more often than it does not.
Dr. Smith, you mentioned that we use our memory for planning for the future. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. So we use the memory for planning the future in broad ways. So as I also said, memory is part of how we understand who we are. It's also how we plan for the future. So how do I make a decision about what I need to do next week? Partly, I need to be able to remember, who am I? What are my responsibilities? What are my goals? So that I can figure out what I need to do in the future. So that can be used for planning for the future, but memory is also part of how we actually carry out future intentions. So a subset of the memory research field is called prospective memory. Prospective memory is remembering to perform an action in the future when you decide you are going to do something, but you can't do it at that point. So you've decided that you want to perform an action, but you have to delay carrying out that action. So say you get up in the morning and you run out of milk. Well, you need to get to work. You can't go buy milk in the morning. So you need to go to work, and you need to remember later in the day on your way home to stop and buy milk. So you've formed an intention to do something. You can't carry it out right now. You need to remember to do it in the future. So that is prospective memory. So we're using memory to remember something in the future. So prospective memory is a very important part of memory, even though it's not the kind that we often think about when we talk about memory. But prospective memory, or remembering to do something in the future, is very important for maintaining independent living. So if you can't remember to turn off the stove, or you can't remember to take medication, then you're not going to be able to live without assistance. So we often think about prospective memory as being important for these daily function activities, but it's also very important for functioning well in social situations. So if your employer asks you to do something and you don't do it, they're not going to be happy with you. If you do that enough, you might lose your job. If you think about other sorts of social situations, so a relationship between a husband and a wife, if the wife is asking the husband, who was at the party yesterday, and the husband can't remember, she's probably just going to think, well, he didn't remember, right? She probably won't take that personally. She'll just think, oh, that was a memory thing. Might be worried about the memory, but not going to be worried that he doesn't care about her. Whereas if you ask your spouse routinely to do things for you and they always forget to do those, you're going to start to think they don't care about you, which has a very social consequence.
Yeah. Okay, well, also, you know, how can we avoid forgetting to do things that we plan to do?
So there are a number of different things, some of which I think people naturally do. One is to make lists and to learn to use those lists. So doing a to-do list and remembering to look at that list, using calendars. We have a lot of new technology that can help us to remember things. So many people have smartphones that have calendar settings that will alert them 15 minutes before they need to go to a meeting. They also have now location settings on many of these devices, so they can remind you to give the dog the medicine when you get home. So you don't get that alert while it's on the day you need to do it, but it doesn't help you if you're at the office. It's when you get home that you need the reminder to say, don't forget to give the dog their flea medicine. And so we have lots of reminders of those sorts. The other thing is to try to turn them into something that's not a prospective memory. So the key defining feature of a prospective memory task is that you have to remember to do these things without somebody prompting you. But by setting a reminder, having something that will cue you, ask you to do something, that means now all you have to do is to try to remember what to do. And if you've got that to-do list, you eliminate some of the burden that makes that task difficult. So using lists, trying to use automated reminders, and developing routines that help you to remember to use those features, but also asking somebody to help remind me to do something, help me remember what it was I was supposed to do. Those are a few things that might help people to avoid making those kinds of errors.
Let me just take a moment for those of you who may just have joined us and are wondering where we are on reading the articles from Reminisce magazine. We have a very special show going on today. We have in our studio, we're very proud to have Dr. Rebecca Smith, who is professor and chair of psychology department at the University of Mississippi, who's written numerous articles, scientific articles on memory, and Dr. Reed Hunt, who is also a research professor at Ole Miss. He's authored also a lot of scientific articles on memory, has written three books on memory, and has appeared on Frontline as an expert witness. Let me get back to you here on the show with earlier you said people only remember when notice when their memory fails. Could you expand on that memory failure for a bit?
Sure. Memory failure actually falls into two broad categories, only one of which people really notice. And that's the obvious case of forgetting. Forgetting essentially is the case in which you are unable to produce or to recognize material that is in fact stored in memory. It's a frustrating state. You know when you've forgotten, but many times, though, you fail to recognize or you fail to particularly recall and blame your memory, and it's not your memory's fault. What I mean by that is, take for example the common situation where you're introduced to three people, and that may take 30 seconds to do. And then you turn to the first person and address them, and you can't remember their name. Many people assume that that is a failure of memory and a particularly frustrating one. But in fact, in most cases, the information was never in memory at all, because in order for something to gain access to memory, there must be attention. That is, you have to actively process that information and think about it before it's going to go into memory. And many times when we're introduced to other people, we're not thinking about their names at all. We're thinking about things such as what we're going to say, what we think about the person, and so forth and so on. So I would offhand estimate that maybe as much as 90% of what normal, healthy people experience when they say they're forgetting is actually a failure to store in memory in the first place. But on the other hand, certainly forgetting is a real phenomenon. Information that was available in memory is no longer accessible. It happens to all of us. There is nothing unusual about it. even as frustrating as it may be. Now, there is a second class of memory failure that most of us are unaware of. And in that regard, it may be the more serious type of memory error. And that's the case in which we have false memory. We're unaware of false memory because false memory simply is a genuine memory, and I emphasize a genuine memory, that turns out not to be accurate in the sense of the memory doesn't correspond to what happened in the past. And yet you have this very, very clear memory. It's dangerous in the sense of it can lead you to act on that false information. In some cases, it's just mildly embarrassing that you may say something to someone based on something that you thought happened that didn't happen. Or in other cases, it can be pose a serious problem, such as failures of eyewitness identification, for example. The real mystery here and the real problem with false memory is you, the individual, don't know it's happening. When you forget, you know it's happening. But when a false memory occurs, all you experience is memory. And you will act on that false memory as if it were a real memory.
Now, Dr. Hunt, you mentioned that false memory can be an absolutely critical scenario and cause dramatic consequences. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, the example I used was in eyewitness identification. I think most people now are aware of the controversial nature of eyewitness testimony, and this would be the case in any number of crimes, but it is quite often the case that in serious crimes, sometimes even the only evidence the police and prosecution have is the eyewitness identification. And in those cases, you want to be very careful to do the best you can, at least, to ensure the accuracy of that person's memory. And once again, here's the problem with false memory. As I said earlier, you, the individual, don't know that you're having a false memory because we're not talking now about lying. We're not talking now about somebody being unsure. We're talking about somebody who is very sure about their memory, as we normally are. And in the case of eyewitness identification, we have a very serious situation. And if that's the only evidence in the case, then nobody else is sure about what happened. And so that testimony based on the eyewitness identification will sway a jury one way or the other, and in that regard must be treated very carefully. Now, the really good news is the authorities, the police, generally, the prosecution are aware of this problem, and that's because of many instances in the past of failure within the judicial system, and we know that it failed because eyewitness testimony was taken to be true when it wasn't, and we know that now because DNA analysis is available. And we can go back after the fact if the DNA has been left at the scene and determine if that's the case. Just to give you one quick example, I was part of the trial here in North Carolina of Ronald Cotton. This occurred years ago in Alamance County where he had been accused of rape, and it was based entirely on the eyewitness of the victim. There was no question whatsoever that a crime had been committed here. No doubt about that. The witness stated in testimony and even later that she spent an hour studying the perpetrator's face so she would be able to remember it later if she lived. And subsequently, this fellow, whose name is Ronald Cotton, was in fact arrested. There were lineups administered to the victim. In the first lineup, actually, it was a photographic lineup. So she saw photos. Nobody was identified. Then a second photo lineup was shown. At that point, one person was familiar in that lineup. And then finally, a third lineup, namely a physical lineup, occurred. And at that point, she was very confident that Ronald Cotton had committed the crime. As it turns out, much later, Ronald Cotton was exonerated and released from state penitentiary on the basis of DNA evidence. But at trial, the victim was terribly convincing because she was totally confident that Ronald Cotton was the perpetrator. The jury was convinced. And it's a lesson, among other things, in what we've since learned. Confidence in your memory is no predictor of its accuracy, because in this case, the memory turned out to be wrong. We now know why the memory was wrong, namely Ronald Cotton was the only constant presence in those three lineups. So in the first lineup, he wasn't identified. He was in the second lineup, but he's now familiar. Remember, memory uses prior experience. So he's now familiar. And in the third lineup, she's now confident that Ronald Cotton is the perpetrator. In the end, this turned out to have a relatively happy ending. Ronald Cotton and the victim met, and they became friends, and they have now spoken together very often on national media about their concern about the use of eyewitness testimony in judicial settings. It all turned on a false memory that nobody knew was false until we had the DNA evidence.
We have talked about a lack of confidence in our memory, but when do we need to be concerned about that?
So people do often worry, well, if they forget something, they forget someone's name, they may get worried about, am I beginning to have great difficulties in, am I getting dementia? Is this a sign of something more significant? The first thing is it's important to remember that memory difficulties can be caused by many factors and not just dementia. So if you are depressed, we will often see some memory difficulties associated with depression. Medications can cause memory failures and difficulties. And then sometimes things that really don't have anything to do with memory at all but are due to perceptual difficulties can mask as a memory difficulty. So an example would be my mother-in-law, Nancy, was, I thought, maybe beginning to have some memory difficulties. So at the dinner conversation, she didn't seem to be following along or sometimes would repeat something that somebody just said. And it turns out that her memory was just fine and remained fine for the rest of her life. What was in problem was that she couldn't hear correctly. And so because she couldn't hear correctly, she wasn't able to then follow along and participate in the conversation. And so she might hear a piece of the conversation and then repeat it. So it came across as being a memory difficulty when in fact it was a perceptual difficulty. So one factor is to think about memory, what looks like a memory error or problem may not be anything to do with memory at all. And so that's an important reminder to go talk to your healthcare provider and check with them if you're having memory difficulties, because they can help you diagnose, is it really a memory problem or is it something like depression, a side effect of medication, or perhaps a perceptual difficulty. But there are, of course, times when people do have signs of memory difficulties that may be leading to something more significant. And so some signs that would indicate that perhaps the memory difficulty is more fundamental would be things like getting lost in a very familiar location. So you're in a neighborhood that you've known very well for a long time, and you go for a walk and find you can't find your way home. That would be something that would be of concern. Not being able to remember the name of somebody from whom you're very close to, that would also be another indicator. And sometimes there's sort of forgetfulness, like, oh, did I remember to pay that bill or not? That's sort of a normal kind of forgetfulness. Whereas, let's say you pay that same bill 10 different times, that would be a more significant cause for concern. The National Institutes of Health provides a great deal of information about when to be concerned and what to do if you are concerned. And so that would be www.nia.nih.gov. So that's for the National Institute on Aging, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. And they have a great deal of information about where to get help and when to be concerned and when not to be concerned.
Based on our society's concern now about dementia and all the effects on our aging population, is the study of memory, is this a more recent occurrence, or has it got some history behind it?
The study of memory in psychology has a very long history. The recent concerns, building over the last 25 or 30 years about dementia, have certainly brought the topic of memory and memory research to the public's attention. And that's a good thing in that it also brings it to the attention of politicians who fund research in scientific memory. But it can have its downsides, too, in that people are even more focused on how fragile memory is as opposed to how powerful and useful it is. But to your question, scientific memory research is formally marked by the publication by a fellow by the name of Herming Ebbinghaus of a book in 1885 where he first published his book on experiments in memory and has proceeded unbroken since that time. So it's quite old, actually.
Well, great. And I think you've allayed a lot of concerns about folks who are concerned about their memory. And we'd like to thank Dr. Rebecca Smith and Dr. Reed Hunt for joining us today on Reminisce. And we'll go back to our regular programming next month. But I just want to say thank you again. And I know we've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce, but sure to listen and tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jim Butts, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. So long until next time.